Welcome back, everyone, all informed ladies and awakened gentlemen around the world. It's great to have you with us. Thank you for tuning in. This is Red Ice Radio. Our website is redicecreations.com. And my name is Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, the land of Goths and Vikings. We come to you three times per week. Mostly we do two-hour shows, and sometimes we also do 1 hour, usually due to the time restraints on behalf of the guests, in case you're wondering. We also have Radio 314 with Lana. You can hear one of these new programs, usually every other Odin's Day. Today we're spending an hour with Australian academic researcher and political scientist Frank Salter. He's a researcher at the former Max Planck Institute for Behavioral Physiology. He is the author of the book on genetic interests, family, ethnicity, and humanity in an age of mass migration. And this is what we're going to speak about today. Salter has argued that multi-ethnic societies are often confronted with the problem of discrimination and group conflict. He's written that more ethnically homogenous nations are better to build public goods, are more democratic, less corrupt, have higher productivity and less inequality, they're more trusting and care more for the disadvantaged, develop social and economic capital faster, they usually have lower crime rates, are far more resistant to external shocks, and are better global citizens, for example, by giving more foreign aid. Moreover, they are less prone to civil war, the greatest source of violent death in the 20th century. This is some fascinating research that you've never heard about in the media or the academic world, and not even in the alternative media, I would say, as it counters and breaks apart the arguments that the globalists and the elites keep telling us regarding their pipe dream of multiculturalism. Welcome, Frank Salter. Thank you so much for coming on the program with us. It's a delight to have you on. Thank you for taking time talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Now, tell us a little bit about your background here first and how you got onto the track of writing on genetic interests, family, ethnicity, and humanity in the age of mass migration.
Yeah, it's part of my professional biography. My PhD, completed in Australia, was a field study of hierarchy, dominance, in a number of organizations, including politics, parliaments, councils, bureaucracies, and so on. And it was clear that one cannot study dominance without studying affiliation or bonding, friendly behaviors between people. For example, very rarely will a command, that's what I studied. My first book was on command or directives given by bosses to subordinates. Very rarely is a command given without a softening, a smile, a tilt of the head. The command put in terms of a request, would you please do that? When there's no need for a request, if the boss has the power to command, well, then why give a request? And the fact is that humans live very much, but people want to live in a soft, affiliative environment. That was finished, that phase of research was completed in the mid-90s, and I began doing different things, including studying mate choice, for example. Social mobility was interesting. But I was very interested in pursuing affiliation as a contrast to dominance. And as a political scientist, I'm interested in society-wide attachment, society-wide bonds. That drew me to ethnicity. So I began studying ethnicity, which is the widest circle of altruism that can be shown. It's not invariably shown, but it can. So ethnicity can be mobilized and can result in a very mild form of attachment, familiarity across a society. That interested me. How can that happen? And how can you have the reverse breaking out? Ethnic conflict, in contrast, can be the most savage, to the point where people risk their lives to kill the opposition. So yeah. you have this negative altruism and passion associated with it. And class theories, Marxist theories, simply fail to explain why people would behave in such a crazy manner. And the love that's shown, the bonding that's shown, is also crazy. It's also not explained by either economic models of rationality or class models. So that's what got me started. And as an evolutionist, the first question with altruism is, what is the genetic similarity between the individuals? Is there a genetic similarity? And that question emerges from the work of William Hamilton, an English ethologist and geneticist, whose 1964 paper on the subject transformed evolutionary biology. He introduced the concept of kin selection, or he preferred to call it inclusive fitness theory, and he argued that two closely related individuals, such as mother and child, siblings, grandparent and grandchild, have a genetic stake. They have a genetic interest in one another. So that can actually be adaptive to risk your life and limb to help relatives, because they're carrying a good part of your own genome. So I began exploring that in with ethnicity, and this is mid-90s, right? So this is 30 years after William Hamilton pioneered this biological theory of inclusive fitness. 30 years, no one had done it. No one had quantified what ethnic kinship is. How strong is it? So to put the question precisely, the question I was trying to answer, I began writing to world-famous geneticists around the world.
Mm.
Here's the question. If you pluck two random individuals from an ethnic group, they might be on different continents as long as they belong to the same ethnic group. How related are they? Is it like cousins 1,000 times removed? That's what I imagined. I imagined that it would be, there would be a connection, but so marginal that it would explain very little, except in aggregate. That's what I assumed. And I wrote, and professors such as the famous Cavalli-Sforza, an Italian geneticist who works at Stanford University, mm-hmm. wrote back, he didn't know what I was talking about. He said, I wrote to others, no response, they just didn't know what I was talking about. But finally, Henry Harpending, a senior American geneticist, wrote back and said, your question is confused. You should be asking this. And he sort of clarified, and in a big email exchange, he taught me some genetics and answered the questions. And we used databases existing at that time to work out that ethnic kinship is typically at the level of first cousins. In other words, about 1,000 times what I had guessed. 1,000 times stronger genetic similarity between random co-ethnics than my initial complete wild guess.
Hmm.
And I was already writing my book on genetic interests, but I had to, in a way, begin again because the connection was much stronger than I had thought.
Maybe you can just explain that for people, what that means in terms of what you mean both with genetic interest and maybe get a little bit deeper into this point of the need to both identify but also wanting to, I guess, be with other like oneself, right?
Yeah. Genetic interest is a term, a shorthand term. It's not a technical term. It's a shorthand term often used by geneticists and evolutionists. The idea is best brought out by the distinction between proximate and ultimate interests. If I have a proximate interest, that means I consciously want it. For example, I'm hungry. Imagine I'm hungry, I've gone bushwalking and I'm lost, and I get hungry or thirsty. I have an interest in finding food and water. Okay? Now, I don't know it at the time. The person who's scavenging for food doesn't realize it, but that actually there's a genetic interest in finding food and water, because if you don't survive, then you can't reproduce. And your genetic interest, that's an ultimate interest. It doesn't have to be conscious. It could be, but in principle it doesn't have to be. You have an ultimate interest in survival in order to reproduce for genetic continuity. So there's an example of a genetic interest that's not conscious, but it still exists. So survival can be a genetic interest because it helps you reproduce your genes. But it could also be a proximate interest in the sense that you're consciously aware of it, you're actively seeking, you know, food and water for obvious reasons. Because you, as an organism, you are adapted to have that response to shortage of food or water. So people have, and not only people, all species that are gene-based have genetic interests. So it's quite a profound statement to say that humans also have genetic interests, because it ties us into nature. We're not separate from nature. We are part of nature. We are evolved organisms that have genetic interests. And I have to say that that concept alone has brought the down on my head the fury of sociologists, for example, who think it's immoral, wrong in some way, for me to use the term genetic interests and apply it to humans. Now let's talk about the second part of your question, which was, what about preferring being around people that are similar in various ways? This is a universal tendency among human beings, but it's a weak background factor to affiliation, to social behavior. But it's so pervasive that it can build up and have large aggregate effects. People generally, birds of a feather flock together, not only among birds, but among humans. And the same applies, by the way, between ethnic groups and between races. So studies done of couples who've married interracially or interethnically find that they are more strongly similar on personality or on hobbies, for example, or religion, than people who marry within their ethnic group. So what is happening? Well, what appears to be happening is that people who are dissimilar ethnically make up for it by being similar on other variables. But for most of us, there is a weak tendency, but pervasive tendency, to want to socialize with people who are of similar ethnicity and similar in other ways, similar personality, similar hobbies, similar accents, similar language, and so on, and to marry them. Right? So this is consistent with Hamilton's theory too of inclusive fitness, because when you form friendships, then you set up reciprocity and you set up weak altruism, which can benefit the other people's genes in the sense of their survival chances and their reproductive chances. Not in modern societies, but in the societies that we evolved in, you know, in tribal societies.
Well, see, that's an important point. I want to try to return to that a little bit later there. In terms of that bond kind of breaking and what occurs in that scenario. But before we move on here, let me just ask you, how is your view in terms of genetics and how powerful they are? Are we ultimately slaves to our genes, as some scientists have suggested, I guess? Are you of that belief?
No, I don't think we are slaves to our genes. The obvious proof of that is that people behave maladaptively. In fact, whole Western societies are behaving maladaptively by allowing themselves to be replaced in their historic territories. Now, if we were slaves to our genes and our genes knew what they were doing, this would be the last thing we would allow. So small-scale immigration, tourism, there's no adaptive issue there. But large-scale, permanent, replacement-level immigration is, from an evolutionary perspective, crazy, and it's quite normal in Western societies, and I might add only Western societies.
Yes.
So we're not slave to our genes. We are very strongly cultural beings. We're evolved. We are genetically cultural. There's no contradiction there. We are evolved to be strongly cultural, and this has been remarkably successful for us. And the adaptive feedback loop that led to that grew this very expensive organ we have called a brain, grew it who three times its predicted size by body mass. It's three times what it should be. And it's a very energetically very expensive organ to have, a brain. But we need it for these large associative centers, learning, passing on traditions, learning new skills, technology, of course. Technology is not genetically based. It's based on culture. So we have cultural evolution going along in parallel to genetic evolution. So we're not slave to our genes, in other words.
Right, right. Now, let me ask you here, if you consider then, I mean, you've kind of already answered this in a way here, in terms of race, if that is something that is irrelevant, and how important this ultimately is to human beings, and since we have a couple of different variables here, in terms of we have genetic interest in itself, and then we have the cultural factor that you talked about, I guess I would include education in that as well, maybe even other factors that make us make life choices, if whatnot. But if we for a moment specifically look at the West, we are, I guess, asked or educated not to put focus on race anymore. I guess that's partly due to the wrath of the sociologists that you mentioned before. But how is this dynamic? How do you see that this playing out? Is race irrelevant, Frank?
Race is both completely irrelevant, but also very important. So it depends on one's perspective. Let me just start from the perspective of the modern mainstream cultural elites in the West. Race is very important for them in a number of ways. On the one hand, they instruct our children at school, and we are instructed through the mass media that race is irrelevant and that discriminating on the basis of race is repugnant to civilized values. On the other hand, the same elites endlessly talk about race. They can't get it off their minds. They can't get it off out of the school curriculum or from the media. We have Hollywood movies which hover around ethnic issues. When I open the morning newspaper, on every page there's a story that touches directly or indirectly on race. So what is happening? I think that race is in fact, and I'm using race now to mean ethnicity.
Yeah.
So I'm using race, which is technically incorrect. So there's tremendous confusion in our political culture about what race actually is. There are two agendas running simultaneously. On the one hand, one is not permitted to talk about, if one is white, one is not meant to talk about racial interests and racial preferences and so on. But on the other hand, it's completely confused. It's not made clear what actually is meant by race. Even people who object to, for example, there's a problem with Islamic immigration to Western societies and some people's minds. When they complain about that, I've often seen them accused of racism.
Sure.
It's nothing to do with race. They're talking about religion.
Yeah.
So there we have a confusion among the journalists and the political elites that are accusing them of racism. That's not race. On the other hand, if one looks at the United Nations declarations against racism, they in the definitional paragraphs, they define race as any descent group, ethnicity, clan, and so on. Physical differences, which is closer to the modern meaning of race. So the meaning itself is confused, but we're not meant to talk about it. But how can we be nice, obedient people and obey these politically correct commands if we're not told what race is, actually? So there is tremendous confusion. I've written a series of articles trying to explain how this confusion arose.
Exactly, in the Quadrant magazine as well. Last time I checked, that was actually not, the website wasn't up, but if it is up now at this stage, we'll link to it so people can read this, a little bit more about this for themselves. Really in-depth, really interesting stuff. Now, how did we go then from a focus on you know, biology, evolution, etc., all these items, to kind of the skewed social sciences that we have today. What is at play here? What is the agenda in your view, Frank?
Well, the agenda is best brought out by the history, by considering the history. And the best book I've read on it is a book by a colleague, Eric Kaufman, in London. He teaches in London. And the book is called The Rise and Fall of Anglo-America. The Rise and Fall of Anglo-America, Harvard University Press, 2004. But there have been other authors trying to explain why evolutionary biology, Darwinism, however one calls it, was driven out of the social sciences from about 1920 through to the 1980s, when it began to trickle back in limited ways, but still has not arrived back where we were. And to understand that history, one has to look at the war that was waged on human nature. That's the way I characterize it. A war was waged on human nature, and the center of conflict was the American university system. Not only that, the elite university system. Columbia University in New York, for example, the Ivy League universities. And the so-called new social sciences, that's how they called themselves, the new social sciences, which came in and became dominant in the 40s and 50s, and also new historiography, for example, which was victorious a little bit before then, 1940s, excluded human nature. Now, why would they do that? Well, there's associated ideological battles. For example, communism, Marxism, far leftism was triumphant intellectually. Had a tremendous momentum, and it had a utopian side to it. It had a utopian socialist agenda, and the last thing they wanted to hear, these people, was actually, there's a relatively fixed human nature that you can't change, and that one must accommodate and one must deal with it. One must organize social systems, political systems around an immovable human nature. Because immovable because it's genetically based, it's innate, and it's universal as well. They didn't want to hear that. And so, you know, it was central to the intellectual agenda of the far left to repudiate this notion of a human nature, of an evolved human nature, what goes with that is the idea of innate interests, whether it be, you know, looking after one's own children, having control of one's own family life, having control of one's own community, having the right to choose one's own spouse and friends, and which implies, we know most people will discriminate on a whole range of bases, not just according to ethnicity or race, but they'll discriminate according to personality, to religion, to language, to appearance, to background, and so on. And to the left, this was a repugnant thing. They wanted to a one-world society of brothers and sisters around the world, of course. For them, class was important, all important, and other identities meant nothing or should mean nothing. So the interesting thing was that there was a conflict, a tremendous culture war going on in Western universities. Its beginnings were around 1900. It goes way back. Franz Boas, for example, migrated to the United States in the late 19th century, but certainly by 1920. By 1920, he was really well established at Columbia University in New York. He was essentially a communist whether he belonged to the Communist Party or not is not relevant. He was communistic. He, when the Soviet Union came into existence in late 1917, he supported it. Was always an apologist for the Soviets. And this is through the Stalinist years, by the way. He was an apologist for Stalinist Russia. And here we have a man of immense influence in American anthropology. Some of his students went on to have profound influence on political science and sociology. And it's not widely known, but the Cold War was lost. The West lost the Cold War culturally. It won it geopolitically when the Soviet Union collapsed from 1989 through to the early 90s. We won that sort of objective geopolitical level of Cold War, but we lost the cultural Cold War. And the reason we don't talk about it is that those who would be talking about it are the children of the victors. it's a message that is met with a blank stare. People just don't know what to make of it. And it's difficult because we are all influenced by that defeat. But the thing is, our houses are not hurt. Our daily routines are not hurt. What's hurt is our minds, our consciousness.
Yes.
So the way we look at the world, the prism through which we view reality and society has been altered. And we carry that prism around with us. So we're caged, as Max Weber called it, we're caged by mere concepts. But these are powerful concepts. We lost the cultural Cold War, and somehow we have to find our way back to viewing reality as it is. It's a really interesting, so you can see that this question you asked leads to profound questions about how we think.
Yes.
And I mean the most educated members of society. As a rough rule, the more educated one is, I don't mean scientifically or in engineering, I mean in the cultural and social science fields. The more educated one is, the more confused one will be about nationality, ethnicity, and race.
Wow. Yeah. How about that? I mean, they've turned their backs on nature, as you said, and human nature, and specifically the war has been on this fixed human nature. We've seen the attempt by this, you know, educational and cultural elite to try to destroy the family unit, for example, of course, demonizing nationalism. This has been very efficient in the last, 50, 60 years here. I wanted to ask you a little bit more here about what would happen if we proceed on the path that we are on right now in the Western world. Obviously, one of the big issues here we're going to get to more in detail is on the issues of immigration, mass immigration, that this aspect has huge costs to the host country, not just financially, but of all the things we've talked about so far. If this continues then to go unchallenged, can you tell us a little bit of the picture that you see emerging out of a scenario like that?
That question is often answered apocalyptically. That's not my approach. I prefer Hannah Arendt's term, the banality of evil, and I think the evil that the evil future that awaits us if we continue on our present course is banality. So to put some flesh on those bones, I would see the West being absorbed into an amorphous world population. So in the sense that the identities that underlie the Western nation state and Western cultures will become fractured blurred, and less those populations will become progressively, or rather regressively, less able to defend their collective interests. I think crime, cultural level, standards of living will tend to merge around the world. And some of these are explicit goals, of course, by globalists.
Sure. Yeah.
My first article in Quadrant was in 2010. It was in response to a series of people, intellectuals from the left to the right, and none of them on the extreme of the left or the right. These were mainstream journalists and people writing for one for a libertarian think tank, for example, and they were arguing for open borders. By open borders, they meant whoever wants to come to Australia should be able to come as long as they're not terrorists. So the only bar was they not be a terrorist. And the explicit reasoning was it's immoral for anyone to be wealthy when there's poverty in the world. So the goal would be you open the borders, and of course Australian standard of living would collapse, it would decline. And when it reached the level of the poorest third world society in Africa or the subcontinent, then of course immigration would naturally stop, because people would not want to come to a strife-torn, poverty-stricken, starving country, you see. These are serious intellectuals, argue this. And so in response, I said, look, there are actually very good reasons to retain nation states. They have an easy peace, domestic peace is easy to maintain because there's not great diversity. As diversity grows, the risks of civil conflict grow. Also, you have ethnic stratification by class. This is the most invidious thing that one can have, especially in a democracy, where you have people who for non-discriminatory reasons, just for the reasons of their own traditions, and, you know, different groups have different talents and different traditions of how they perform in an economic way, you have stratification. This is demoralizing. It tears at the moral fabric of society. That would become normal. If we allow this mass immigration to continue to Western societies, we're going to have these things increasing. So I have a banal view of the outcome of replacement level migration. So America is destined to become minority white by about 2040. Already, whites are in a minority of children being born now already. And I just think America is in inevitable decline as a result, because of the diversity. Diversity is something that needs to be handled very carefully within a state. Between states, diversity is fine. In fact, it's a wonderful thing to have, diversity around the world. But within a state, it's positively dangerous. And this is something, again, that is considered taboo. One is not meant to say that.
Yeah, that's right.
But the rising diversity is going to help, it's going to end Western civilization, which is a unique thing, and it's a benefactor for all of humankind, it seems to me, and something to preserve.
Well, I agree. I wholeheartedly agree with that. I think that if we look at some of the people that have advocated some of these issues that we've been talking about here, then it seems to me that the very enemy itself is Western civilization. There's a lot of arguments going around here in terms of endorsing, I guess, this treatment of any white population, basically, that they somehow deserve the treatment in this regard that they're getting. This, of course, is not only an admission then to that the diversity actually is causing problems, which they, you know, denounced from the beginning, but that this has something to do with past, you know, colonization, past history. The people alive today have somehow are somehow responsible and have to carry this multi-generational burden on their shoulders. What is your answer to an argument like this?
Well, the first point is notice the ethnic hostility implicit in such a statement. You've already said that. It's a statement of hatred and of vengeance. It's the V2. It's the V2 rocket of modern leftist ideology. Don't forget the Hitler's V2 rocket.
Right. Yeah.
The V stood for vengeance because of the large-scale bombing that had been happening. Vengeance. So it's implicitly highly ethnocentric. In fact, implicitly hate-based. It's saying you're going to get your just desserts. And who's you? You is the white world. And implicitly, the we is the various non-white races. Quite extraordinary. I mean, it just, again, confirms my argument that we have widespread confusion in our political cultures, but we can't even talk about these things sensibly. I mean, for someone to make what is really, in effect, a racist comment like that, and pretend to make it in opposition to racism is extraordinary. It's complete confusion. At the analytical level, it's complete confusion. It's mainly valuable for revealing the motivation that is there. Now, in Australia, I've been reading since I arrived back from overseas. I've been overseas for many years, and I arrived back in late 2011 and began reading the media here and watching and reading the media. And I kept coming across anti-white slurs. Anti-white slurs coming from people who consider themselves anti-racist. So what is happening? Well, they identified with the multicultural movement, with a movement for minority rights and dignity and tolerance, all sounding very positive. But in fact, they are anything but post-ethnic. So there's a central ideological contradiction in multiculturalism. As multiculturalism is offered up to Western majorities, it portrays itself as post-ethnic, colorblind. But those doing the offering up come in two main groups that are allied. On the one side are white leftists, for whom this is generally at least an ideal, being post-ethnic, being colorblind, treating people according to their own individual characters, not according to the color of their skin. This sort of doctrine. They at least have that as an ideal, but they're in intimate alliance with minority activists who are very different, very different. These people are proud of their ethnic identity. They're often resentful about their minority status. They want to increase their numbers through immigration. They are often resentful of what they see as white racism. They are tribal warriors. I call them tribal warriors. They're the absolute opposite of post-ethnic, colorblind people. See, and yet we have an alliance. How is it possible that we have an intimate alliance? Because multiculturalism is an alliance between the white left and the minority tribalist, really far right,
right.
In those terms. They're actually on the far right of the political spectrum because they subordinate all sorts of other issues to their own ethnic interests. So how is it possible that we have this alliance going on and the question is unanswered? I don't pretend to have any simple answer. I have some ideas. My main one is that the problem focuses on white leftists. How can they not be repulsed by the tribalism of their minority allies? That's the key question or answer. And I think it's because they suffer from ethnic autism. It's a shorthand term, meaning that they're so insensitive, they're so hyper individualist that they just can't read other people's intentions when they avoid, you know, overt racism. But so when a person and also they're driven by victimhood. They will overlook ethnocentrism in people they perceive to be victims, ethnic victims.
Yeah.
This is just some ideas, but it's a remarkable contradiction. But it's a dangerous contradiction, because that alliance, it's and only that alliance could result in the extraordinary hostility and hatred shown to Western peoples, and leading to this mass replacement level migration. One test of that idea would be putting to these people, and I've done this in conversation, putting to them, how would you feel about an immigration policy that replaced African peoples with, say, Chinese people?
Right.
By the way, that is an actual scheme that was presented in the late 19th century by a British intellectual.
Huh.
Look, these Africans aren't very productive, but if Africa became Chinese, we could trade with them, they'd be useful partners, and it'd make everyone happier and wealthier. Let's just replace Black Africa with Chinese. Jeez. Serious argument.
Wow.
Now, the response I get from leftists is, that is typical white racism. That is an amazing, barbarous thing to do. How insensitive, you know. Africa for the Africans, slogans like that come out.
Yeah.
Africans they're human beings. They have a right to survive as a people. This is shocking. But and then when I say, yes, but what you want for the West is essentially the same. Why don't you then oppose the replacement level migration that's being inflicted on a great number of Western societies by elites that never ask the people's permission? They never put a vision to them saying, look, we'd like Sweden in 50 years to be, you know, 50% non-white. Is that all right with you? How do you feel about that?
No,
it's never asked.
No, that's right.
So we are being treated in the way that this imperialist wanted Africa treated 100 years ago. I get this confusion. I get this confused, complete double standard,
yeah.
Applying people very... applying rules very differently.
Now, let's just tackle this issue a little bit. But people are denying that this is the case. This is not occurring. This is a massive exaggeration. You know, the European peoples will still be a majority in their own countries. This is just, you know, you're completely missing the point of what's happening to Europe. How would you respond to that point?
What's happening, the dynamic driving this, is that European peoples have created societies that are so attractive to others that they want to come in large numbers. And I don't blame them for doing that. This is not blaming immigrants at all. I think I understand them. They want a better way of life. They want to live in free, equal societies with generous welfare systems where their children can have jobs and live a better life. I understand that. But it's not that's not necessarily in the interests of Western societies. What is their interest? Well, obviously to have immigration where it benefits them, but that's not mass immigration. That's letting in specialists, for example, letting in people who can teach in the universities or do particular jobs. That's not mass permanent migration. But that dynamic exists, that magnet for mass migration from the third world exists, and we can see on the horizon now whites falling to minority status in a number of societies. So to say it's not a problem, I'm not sure what is meant by that. It's a fact.
Yeah.
It's a fact that it's happening. I think what they really mean to say is it doesn't matter. That's a different proposition. Saying it doesn't, yes, it's a fact, but it doesn't matter. That's something one could argue about and discuss.
Yeah.
But that's a matter of values.
And as a long-term projection, correct, in terms of birth rates and numbers and everything else that we've seen now, and the watching trends, basically, right? You see a development, and then you have to act on that, correct?
Exactly. Exactly. I don't believe that we're so silly as to have to wait for disaster to strike before acting to protect ourselves. Why not use our intelligence and use our science to project the future and try and steer the future to suit our interests, or at least the interests of our children and grandchildren.
Exactly. I mean, this is a kind of a, you know, not only pathological altruism, it's a suicidal one to that degree, right? The premise here is to a certain extent that we should just kind of give this up and let this go, right? Since there's no such thing as a genetic interest, for example. So in that kind of scenario, it's actually about trying to not only make people see and re-educate, but it actually becomes about trying to bring some sanity and stability into the educational world yet again. From your perspective, and considering, I guess, your treatment as well, Frank, in the academic world and everything else, how do you see that question? Where do we begin to stabilize this very unstable picture?
Yeah, huge. That's a huge question. Just one comment that helps set the stage for trying to provide an answer. The West's loss of the Cultural Cold War resulted in the social sciences and humanities becoming intolerant places. These are places that are not a pleasant workplace for conservatives, let alone people who care about their ethnic groups. There's been some description coming out of, for example, social psychology. Professor Haight in the United States has published on this just a few years ago, pointing out how hostile an environment social psychology is for conservatives. And he argues this is not only unfair, it's discriminatory, of course, but it's also makes for bad science, because conservatives ask different questions, different scientific questions to radicals. You know, so but coming back to your question, how can we reverse this, fight our way back from having lost the cultural Cold War in the universities from such a dismal position? Well, my approach is to demand diversity. That might sound, it's deliberately provocative when I
right.
say that.
Yep.
We should demand diversity of views. And because our winning condition is not a monopoly. By our, I mean those who seek truth in the social sciences. We don't have to have the monopoly that the left has won for itself through its intolerance. Now, all we have to have is a diversity of views, and I believe that humans, when faced with alternate arguments, alternate evidence and so on, will gravitate towards the truth. So my advice to government is to start demanding through its fiduciary, through its funding power, start demanding diversity. You know, for example, demanding that departments of social science have different points of view in there, not all the funding goes to, you know, environmentalist, by environmentalist I mean, theories opposed to human nature, and so on. So that's not only a first step, but I think a sufficient step to revolutionize and effectively win back the intellectual high ground for rationality. And, you know, it only takes clear thinking to reverse some of these insane policies that we see. It doesn't take a return to 19th century traditions that have now been obliterated and probably would be out of place anyway in a post-industrial world. No, we need clear thinking, but it's going to be a struggle because the opposition is intolerant. These people are mobilized. They perceive themselves as on a quest. You know, it's not something that's just naturally come about. This has been the outcome of an aggressive movement, an exclusivist movement of left wing and minority thought.
Well, exactly. A few more questions for you here before we begin to wrap things up here. Will a first world country remain a first world country when an increasing number of third and second world people come into the country? I mean, I guess, to put it in a different way, if there is a level of achievement, let's say, in the West that has been admired and desired in other parts of the world, why not bring this level of achievement and knowledge base for this to the rest of the world as a way of building things up? This is, if we look back historically, this is, of course, how things occurred to begin with within the Western world and in Europe specifically. Instead of this idea of trying to kind of bring in people to the source for it, and in that way kind of, you know, clench the fire, kind of you drown the source inspiration for this, in a sense. That seems to me what actually is occurring, and of course that might be a tactic then, but if you see what I'm trying to get to here, is there a risk that the engine that brought, you know, some of these achievements that were to be admired around the world, is it at risk that the engine will shut down and not being able to start up again, if you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, and I don't think it will require whites in the different countries falling below 50%. You know, already the United States is in serious trouble, structural trouble, as the non-white population grows rapidly. But I just want to make a point here that there's an old racist idea, which I think fed into Nazism and some of the extreme racist movements of the early 20th century, that Western identity is interchangeable with claims of superiority.
Right.
And this is still it's part of the confusion that we have, because the scholarship in ethnic studies has been so confused and so filtered through the mass media and into the educational establishment. A lot of the confusion is on the right as well. So I still come across this idea that white identities, there's a generic white identity, but more importantly, there are white Western identities from Greece through to Ireland.
That's right.
United States. Yeah. But the really what they're talking about, the real low down, is superiority, technical, scientific, IQ, all this sort of thing. Well, not really. The science of IQ, for example, the science of measuring cognitive capacity, learning ability, shows that Europe does fairly well, but it's by no means the highest IQ area in the world. We know that East Asia, for example, has an average IQ of something like 105, 106, while Europe is 100. And also, populations with IQ below 100 can do very well. You know, if the political system's working well, educational system's working well, they can have a successful industrial society. So there are differences between peoples as well. So Yes, it's possible to have a degree of immigration from selected countries around the world that does not compromise civilizational standards, in meaning technical standards. Like I'm narrowing that to mean technical, scientific.
Sure.
But at the same time, that's really dodging the identity question, the identity issue. That should not be dodged. Identity is only indirectly a matter of ability. Yes, they're connected. Yes, you know, one because, for example, science and industry have become part of Western identity, and for a good reason. We invented it, so it's for a pretty good reason.
Yeah.
Science and industry were brought to the highest levels in post-medieval Europe. But there's actually a deeper identity which goes back, which takes us back to medieval, pre-medieval Europe. And it's not simply based on an IQ score, for heaven's sake. How ridiculous can this get? But going back, but answering your question directly, I'm one of those who believes that the best benefit, the greatest benefit we can bring to people that we feel sympathy for, is not just pouring foreign aid at them, but channeling it to build up their culture, to help them retain their and build their own nation states. Very important factor. We know that the diversity in many third world countries, especially African countries, resulting from the tremendous impact of European colonialism, you know, where borders were drawn that cut through tribal groups, that bunched antagonistic tribes together and then expected them to perform like European nation states that had taken multiple centuries to evolve.
Like India and Pakistan is a classic one, right? When the division occurred, millions of people died in that process. Yeah.
They tried to sort themselves out. They did so to a certain extent. But India itself suffers from very high level of diversity, not only ethnic, but caste, linguistic, religious, racial, between North and South. So we inflicted or helped inflict a tremendous level of diversity on these countries.
Yeah.
Which was the first diversity crime, perhaps.
right.
But I do believe that we need to be helping people in their home countries and not bringing their problems to us.
Well, exactly, because in a way that is what is happening, correct? I mean, it's like you can strengthen at the source here instead of bringing some of the issues to other parts of the world. And again, it's nothing to speak negatively about that. I think human history is a very complex issue, and all peoples everywhere have struggled and fought and toiled and with their blood, sweat and tears in the field to attain whatever level they're at, right? And this is something that has been done with, I believe, what you said before about genetic interests. So the opportunity here to, as a nation, to overcome some of these obstacles is a tremendous part of that, building the sense of achievement, building the feeling within the culture and the tribe, if you will, the nation, that you can achieve these things. But when this kind of idea comes of spreading the issues away from the source of, bringing people into the Western world and ergo think it's going to be better because of that, I don't think it's going to help. That's just the issue. I don't think that that's going to solve anything at the end of the day. There's going to be issues there that still will have to be overcome by the people, whether people realize that or not. What would you say to that, Frank?
Yeah, I agree. The way I put it is this. I started this interview by talking about affiliation, bonding, and that ethnic and national ties are the largest that we know of. And when one tries, as the far left has tried to do, to extend this level of attachment to the whole world, it collapses because we just don't feel that way about people at random. The strongest ties adhere to identity groups, whether it be the family, which is the most intense, and coming down a long way, whether it be an ethnic group or a nation, then you can still have some low level of connection. But when one tries to go beyond that, which is the communistic ideal, the whole thing just collapses. And basically you have a war of all against all. It's hyper-individualism. The world that I envisage, if we can wrest back control over immigration from globalizing elites, and fight again the cultural Cold War, and this time win it in a reasonable way. The goal that I think we should be aiming towards is what I call the optimization of bonding. Because we all want to live in a society where we feel comfortable, where we feel accepted, where we don't feel, as President Obama in his first book talked about, always being watched because he had of a different race. And he visited Kenya when I think he was in his late 20s. He visited Kenya where his father was born. His father was Kenyan. And he said, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. My race was in the majority. I didn't feel watched. It was great.
Right.
And then he begins talking about his resentment at white tourists. How dare they intrude on Kenya with their arrogance and their insensitivity? Why couldn't when they're in Africa, they should do as the Africans do and behave as they do and so on.
Right.
So the thing is, and this is, but I take one extra step to Mr. Obama and say, he's not the only one who feels that way. A lot of people feel that way. Most of us want to be in a relaxed society where we know our children will be in the ethnic majority and not be discriminated against and not feel watched and feel comfortable as well. And these approximate interests, very understandable. We want to be loved. We want to at least to be left alone and feel relaxed, have our identity needs met. But the wonderful thing is that such societies also meet our genetic interests, because our ethnic groups are the largest families that we have. They're our genetic families, and the welfare of our ethnic groups is very important to our long-term fitness in the sense of genetic continuity. So imagine, I can imagine a world where you have, you know, the 200 or 300 nations in the world being ruled by international rule of law, trading with one another, exchanging, visiting each other countries, tourism, a low level of immigration taking place, of course, around the world as well, but a level that's not high enough to endanger identities in a precipitate, rapid manner. And that actually is achievable once these rules of how to build cohesive, caring societies, once one understands that, then the aim should be to optimize it around the world. Yes, there are trade-offs, of course.
Sure.
People can't go where they want, in any numbers that they want. Yes, there'll be some trade-offs. Corporations won't be able to simply close factories and open factories as they wish, or move millions of people around the world to keep down wage rates in wealthy countries, which is an open corporate policy.
Yep.
Well, part of the problem we've been talking about. Yes, there'll be some downside to it for them, but for the great majority, majorities around the world, there are tremendous payoffs, and there are sustainable payoffs forever, where these societies retain their identities, retain their majority cultures. And I think we all have an interest in what I call universal nationalism. It's a non-chauvinistic nationalism, where the aim is not to conquer and smash other peoples, but to help everyone achieve continuity of these pro-social values of living in an abundant society, of feeling secure, and what goes with it. Ironically, some left values go with it. A caring society with a generous welfare system, for example, typically comes from homogeneous nation states, or relatively homogeneous nation states.
Exactly. Well, again, that point is actually perfectly provable with what the development in Sweden has been, who's gone from this very successful, if you will. Well, I mean, for we had a free market for a long time, which of course led to the fact that we could even build up the welfare state that we're so proudly touted around the world. But with increasing mass immigration into Sweden, these issues, these aspects have now completely fallen off pretty much. And we're in a, from that perspective, from that left socialist perspective, we're a culture in decline, you know? So I find that this is very correlating, and this is very truthful for, from the point of view of everything that I've witnessed and observed when it comes to Sweden.
Mm, yes. And isn't it sad that that people on the left, and I mean moderate left, who want a caring society where old people, isolated people, people with disorders and illnesses and so on, aren't just left lying in the street where we actually take care of our own, that they're so confused on the science of ethnicity that they're also promoting mass replacement level immigration and the building up of third world neighborhoods and so on.
Exactly.
It's quite extraordinary to see this. These well-meaning people, what's simply lacking is knowledge. That's what they're lacking.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with their motivation, but they think they have to somehow oppose their own people's interests to achieve nirvana. It's really amazing. Sometimes I say, we've gone mad in the West.
Yes.
There's a madness. A recent example is the attack on the billionaire owner of that basketball team in Los Angeles, the Clippers. Donald Sterling. This is an extraordinary event, and no one seems to have noticed, at least in the mass media that I've been reading, no one seems to have noticed that his basic human rights have been violated, trampled on.
Yep.
For example, President Obama, of all people, accused him of being an ignorant man for wanting to shape the ethnic content of his inner circle of friends and associates, and that's just to recall what he did wrong. His faux pas was to tell his girlfriend to request her. He said, "Please, would you not be photographed with black men?" This really jars with modern sensibilities. I find it jarring.
Mm.
I don't like the idea of excluding people on the basis of their race.
Of course not.
But in fact, President Obama, in his book,
has done the same.
Admits to doing. He doesn't admit it. He states it with pride.
Yeah.
That he had a white girlfriend and he pushed her away because she was WASP. She was an Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah.
And he wanted to maintain his own ethnic identity, and so he looked around. He pushed away a multi-ethnic girl, and she said, "Can't you love me for just who I am? I'm just for my individuality." She had multiple ethnic background. No, wasn't good enough, and he looked for a black wife. He says in another part of the book, he said, "I carefully chose my friends." He wanted some black friends, Chicano friends, foreign friends. So what actually has Donald Sterling done wrong? Now, if Donald Sterling, he's accused of making an incendiary statement of, he was accused by the basketball league of this is shocking, he shouldn't have made the statement because it's very bad for race relations and so on. And an argument can be made for that.
Sure.
However, it was not a public statement.
Exactly.
He didn't say something publicly. This was recorded secretly and against his will released to the media. The man, he did nothing wrong, actually. If he did do something wrong, then President Obama should be impeached.
That's right.
You can't have it both ways.
Yep.
And there's this level of insanity where someone's privacy can be trampled on. Why? Oh, because he's a bad man.
That's right.
Because he made personal choices that that we don't like. So it's extraordinary the level of intolerance that one sees in discussions of identity in the West.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are glaring double standards, and I mean, some are held to a different standard than others, and some are just, you know, some are equal while others are not. You know, so I just want to reiterate this point again and strengthen, I guess, this point before we wrap things up at this time here, Frank. But multiculturalism is something that is not going to lead to a peaceful and healthy society, because according to the scientific studies that you've done on this, it is something that's going to lead to more strife, culture clash. We have, of course, the religious question coming into this. I saw a clip from the other day from Australia alone with a huge Muslim demonstration back in 2012, for example. And there are things within the narrative of certain religions and, for example, Western values that they clash. It's just not going to operate and work in that way. So this dream that is going to create a peaceful world where everybody, you know, hold hands and it's a rainbow of happiness, everything that you've studied seems to suggest the opposite, correct?
Yes, except that just one technical point. It depends what you mean by multiculturalism. So, international multiculturalism defines my position. International multiculturalism,
right.
That is striving to help people build their own nation states, and the end result of that, of course, would be sustainable ethnocultural diversity around the world. So, but when one tries to do that within a state, it's essentially a lie. Because in the end, one has assimilation, homogenization, and the loss of diversity. And then, of course, one needs more mass immigration to keep up the level of diversity that is sought. So international multiculturalism I have no problems with. I also have no problem, I would have, or fewer problems, with a genuine democratic multiculturalism within states. And what I mean is this. The problem with what I call Western multiculturalism is that it excludes one ethnic group from the multicultural table, and that is the majority, the founding nation. And multiculturalism, this alliance which I've previously described between the white left and multicultural or minority tribalists, you don't have an alliance unless it's directed at someone, right? So NATO was directed at the Soviet Union and so on.
Yeah.
So, and what it's directed at is white people. Multiculturalism in the West is an alliance, a leftist and minority tribal alliance against the white majority, well, while it's the majority. Why not confront that and bring into the multicultural process, bring in the majority? Why not?
Yeah.
What would happen? Well, the first thing that would happen is imagine the government calling a conference, a multicultural conference, to advise it on policy issues, for example. Well, the white representatives would come along, and by white I mean not calling themselves white, but calling themselves Swedish or Anglo-Australian or Anglo-New Zealand or white American or, you know, so
right. Yep.
Whatever the white ethnic group is or groups are, they would come in and they would be asked, okay, so we've heard from the, you know, from the Chinese delegate that there should be more immigration from China, and we've heard from the Indian delegates and from the Muslim delegates there should be more immigration from India and from Islamic countries, and we've heard from et cetera, et cetera. And now we turn to the representatives of the majority ethnic group. And what would you like? I wonder what they would say. What would they say? Anyone who represents the interests of the founding culture, what would they say? Well, I'd hazard a guess. They'd say something like, yes, we understand the motives driving our colleagues across the table. We understand, of course, they want more of their people. If possible, they'd like to become the majority, each of them probably, in our country. Well, we actually feel the same way. We feel very much the same way, and we'd like more white immigrants, or actually no immigrants at all, perhaps. Maybe net migration could be brought down to zero. Why? Because that suits our interests.
Yeah, yeah.
That suits our interests. And, you know, and if it was a genuine multiculturalism where you had ethnic agencies representing, you know, by representing different ethnic groups. You know what I mean by ethnic agencies. Multiculturalism, part of the formula is that you have the government often sponsoring minority ethnic organizers, giving them perks such as, you know, community centers and funding to attend national and international conferences and funding to do research and access to ministers, to travel to the capital to visit the minister of state and interact, and all these sort of perks and benefits.
Yeah.
And they give that and build up ethnic agencies that represent the interests of the different ethnic minorities in the country. Well, if you had the same thing for the ethnic majority, conducting research, for example, conducting lobbying, having access to high-level decision-makers, both in the bureaucracy and in the parliament, for example, I think the outcome would be dramatically different. Dramatically different. What I'm saying, another way of putting what I just said is, multiculturalism is an assault on democracy. It's undemocratic. It's a way of subordinating the interests of white majorities. And notice they're the majority. So one would expect that in a democracy, the majority generally would get its own way if in such matters. But they're studiously ignored. That's what has been happening. So a democratization of multiculturalism alone, quite apart from nationalism, one wouldn't need a mass nationalist movement or the rest of it. Just a democratization of multiculturalism, I think, would be beneficial. And this is the sort of slogan that should be raised. You know, give us a voice. We want a voice as well. Why do minorities have direct access for lobbying purposes to the government? And why aren't we listened to when we try and do the same thing? Why do you call us racist and call us all sorts of bad names and try and put us in prison? And why have you built this coercive apparatus of courts and special advisors and police to round us up and persecute us when we try and do exactly the same thing as ethnic minorities do? And they call it multiculturalism. When we try and do it, it's called racism. What the hell is going on here?
I know.
And what is happening is that it's a top-down revolution. That's what's happening. It's revolution through immigration.
Yeah, exactly. And just to strengthen that point again, there are people going to jail for these things right now. People are being arrested, etc., and for raising perfectly, you know, valid points and with no enticement of violence or anything like this. The obvious issue here is, of course, that you can realize pretty darn quick that something much more, a bigger picture is at play here than because otherwise, what would be the problem if people question some of these activities and as you said, just to basically adhere to the same behavior that every other minority within the host country is allowed to have? So something is awfully, awfully wrong in this picture, you know?
Yeah, something very sinister is going on. And it's not surprising that something sinister is going on and that it's a non-democratic process and it's a coercive process when you look at the inevitable outcome, which is the swamping of the nation by immigrants over, what, two or three generations it will be achieved.
Yeah.
So, and no people in history have voluntarily allowed themselves to be subordinated in such a way. Subordinated, and two, that subordination leading to being demographically swamped. Generally, not generally, but always in the past, that was the result of invasion and conquest. So before people would allow themselves to be dispossessed of their historic territories, of historic homeland, first they had to be smashed, their armies defeated, resistance put down, and then moved off their land and foreigners brought in. But now, for various historical reasons to do with the centralization of the mass media, centralization of decision making and so on, that's a separate political science and sociological matter of analysis. With various historical reasons, it's being done to us by our own governments.
Yeah.
And as an academic, it's both fascinating and horrifying.
It's absolutely unbelievable. I mean, just the exclusion from the society of the, well, for now, majority, because they somehow are believed to have tremendous, just, you know, supernatural advantages to other, that, you know, knapsack of privilege or what have you, that on that basis there are excluded, and in some cases even losing jobs or job opportunities because of this very issue, you know. But the basic, we could go on for more hours here, Frank, because this is just, we've just brushed on a couple of these points here, and this is just a tremendous discussion, and there's many more things we could have gone into more depth at, but I know that you're very busy, Frank, so we'll have to begin to wrap things up for this time. But let's give out some of the titles here that you have available, where people, and also where people can get copies of your books, and if there's any other websites that you'd like to give out where people can read more about you and your work.
If you go to my website, all my publications are listed. So the website's called socialtechnologies.com.au. socialtechnologies.com.au, and that lists all my publications, and you can also see some of my speeches and interviews. But the main book on the topic actually was an experimental book. It's not meant to be a final statement on the matter of dealing with these matters, but on genetic interests. Originally published in 2003 and then taken up by an American academic publisher, Transaction, and republished in 2007. That's where I launched the idea of universal nationalism, and to bring some of this research together. But it's not the final word, but a lot of it is there. A lot of it is there. I also have edited two books on, or three books actually, on it. One was on indoctrination. That's the first editor was Irenaeus Ibersfeld. The other book is called Risky Transactions, where I was interested in the phenomenon of organized crime often being ethnically based. And also high risk businesses such as middleman trading networks, also especially international trading networks, often being or generally being ethnically based around the world. So in Southeast Asia, for example, Chinese are famous for their ability to conduct international trading networks, which is based not just, by the way, not based on Chinese race or anything. It's based typically on much smaller, on clan and on village back in China that they came from, and then on linguistic, some larger group of one of the Chinese dialects, and religion was brought into that. And then you have the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire, and Jews obviously in Europe were very important ethnic middleman minority. And it's all brought together from an evolutionary theoretical perspective in this book, Risky Transactions. And then another edited book, and this is the last one I'll mention, is called Welfare and Ethnicity, where I brought together an international group of scholars, sociologists, anthropologists, and we looked at this question of does diversity improve welfare states or harm it? And the overwhelming answer was, as diversity rises, welfare goes down.
Yeah.
In the long run, yeah. It goes down. Sometimes it can be held up for a while, but in the end it collapses. But it touches on, is relevant to such issues as why did the Yugoslav Communist Empire collapse? Why did the Soviet Empire collapse? Because they were trying to construct public goods across multiple ethnic identities. So it has, these two books are relevant to topics which are confronting us now. Why, for example, is Venice and the hinterland of Venice trying to secede from Italy? Why is Scotland trying to secede from Britain?
Yeah.
Okay, so these are really deep questions. It's really having an effect. And one has to understand the interaction between altruism and identity. But that's another story, Henry.
Well, definitely. I mean, it's great stuff here. And, of course, the title's again here, On Genetic Interests. Also check out Welfare, Ethnicity, and Altruism, and also Risky Transactions. There are some other titles on Frank's website, and that is socialtechnologies.com.au. Thank you so much for your time today, Frank. Please keep up the good work, and would love to have you back again in the future and continue our conversation on this incredibly important and taboo-ridden topic. So thank you again for your time, Frank.
Thank you very much.
We have more on this topic coming up in future shows. In the meantime, we say thank you for listening. And, of course, if you're new to the program, please take a look at redicecreations.com for much more. We also have redicemembers.com, where you can subscribe and get full access to all programs that we've done since our start in 2006 on a myriad of topics that both interests and engages us in thinking outside of the box and consider less discussed viewpoints. Don't miss our program with Don Park that we just did on Red Eyes Radio for a perfect example on some of the things that we discuss here today, especially how freedom of speech in Sweden, a long-held tradition there, is basically being demolished for the sake of protecting those who feel offended by the virtue of Western values when it comes to critiquing not only religion, but also its own values. Very bizarre and horrible to see how this has turned out in the country. We are going to be back with Joseph Farrell in just a few days. After this, we have Joseph Atwill for more on the typology behind Shakespeare and how this connects with the ancient and historical struggle between groups that has led to genocide. Might sound a bit strange, but it's actually very interesting. Don't miss that one. We also have Vahan Setian with us to discuss Armenian history, pre-Christian tradition, hidden mythology and unknown aspects to their culture and language. We're also going to talk about the Armenian genocide and struggle with current religious opposing forces, both in Armenia and also in Europe. We'll be back with more in just a few days. You can tune in whenever it works for you, stream or download from redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com, our members' website. We have, by the way, full instructions on how to connect with podcast apps using your phone or tablet or other device to our RSS feeds so you can catch the programs on the go. All right, well, have a good day, everyone. Thank you again for considering, and thank you for listening. Stay strong, keep focused, and we'll talk to you in just a few days. Bye-bye.